had a great interest in higher education, and that's what I taught, and I went to Berkeley.
This is what will happen if you go away for a few days.
That's right. Now, I want you to notice, look at the arrangement of the room after our discussion last night.
After our discussion of how education might be improved if we put the chairs more in a circle so that envelop the speaker in the center of attention there, whatever the subject might be, the people have arranged it so we're more in the classical way, back people with people far and farther and farther away from the speaker. But we will do what we can today. It's a very difficult sort of thing to get people to arrange rooms that are for the benefit of the educational process rather than for the benefit of the janitors and the people who run the place, after all. Now, this morning, I was hoping we might focus, at least initially, on some of the differences or similarities between the thought of Bill Petit and Michael Polanyi. Last night, I think we were elaborating more the convictions and thinking of Bill Petit in his writings. And this morning, though we can never control where the discussion will go, I would suggest that we might start out, at least, by asking Bill some questions about how he sees his own thought in relation to Polanyi. I've always regarded Bill not only as Polanyi East, if that's the right phrase to use, but also one of those great allies in attempting to undermine the critical perspective in modern life and make possible the emergence of a post-critical era. And of course, I think Michael Polanyi is very crucial in that kind of development, and Bill is following it. Last night he said something, though, that made me wonder about that
a little bit.
He said that the Polanyian meditation was misnamed, and it should be toward a post-critical philosophy with a subtitle, perhaps, suggested by a passage on page 191 of Personal Knowledge. Now, I would like to hear Bill talk about that a little bit more, the overall relationship he sees between his own thought and that of Michael Polanyi. I think that would be a very interesting thing. And perhaps I can tease that out just a little bit more. For example, Bill talked about seeing his own work as carrying out a Copernican revolution. Now, in my own thinking about Polanyi, it seems to me as though the Copernican revolution was of a particular sort in the centuries that preceded the critical period and permeates the critical period in a certain way, and that the post-critical period is inaugurated by what I would call the Polanyian revolution. Now, I would like to see Bill talk about what he sees the relationship between
the Copernican revolution and the Polanyian
revolution, because I think that would help us see what it is that his own thought is carrying out that is in comparison with and in contrast to the thought of Michael Polanyi. There's another element that I think would be interesting to hear about also, and that's a comparison and contrast of the relation of action and language in Polanyi, and how Bill sees this in his own work. There are times when I read the philosophical day book, for example, when I have a feeling that that Bill is more in the linguistic school of philosophy, but is carrying out some very significant modifications and changes, and that the Copernican revolution he's carrying out really is with reference to what I would say are the misunderstandings and misleading aspects of the school of linguistic philosophy. Partly Hexham, partly Wittgenstein, and others in that field. You know, the group that took them 2 decades to learn that ordinary language is that is not that that is spoken in the senior common room of Magdalen College. This is quite a move for them when they discovered that, of course. Now,
They're slow.
So I would like to see Bill locating himself. I would like to hear how he locates himself with reference to his own Copernican revolution, with reference to that linguistic school, as compared with how he sees himself in relation to Polanyi, that I see as taking an even further move beyond simply showing the difficulties of the linguistic school. And it seems to me as though one of the places where that might focus is in the relation between action and language. And of course, the linguistic school of Oxford, through its Berkeley Bryant Searle, at least began extending speech of speech acts. So they were relating to action. I would like to see how Bill carries this forward and sees the Copernican revolution that his own thought bears in relation to what I would call the Polanyian revolution. Seems to me to go further. Now, there may be some other things, but I think that will at least get us started out and perhaps set the tone of where we would go from there.
I think I'll reserve those other things that you would specify for Volume 3.
All right.
Maybe I'll only consider the subject matter of Volume 2.
All right.
Well, this is a very tantalizing invitation, and I'm going to accept it up to the limits of my capacity to do this, which I should forewarn you is quite limited. Because I have never been a student of Polanyi. And in that fact alone, and I'll tell you what I mean by it, because obviously I see expressions of dismay, perplexity, oh my God, there's more of this coming. No less an authority than Nicol Dunn. In the introduction to their recently published volume, has touted me as one of the great interpreters of Polanyi in the contemporary philosophic scene. This is just plain not so. There are many people, many in this room, who are far better interpreters of Polanyi than I ever was. And certainly than I ever aspired to be. Now, this will help you to understand perhaps a little better some of the things that I was saying about teaching with concrete reference to the questions that Charlie was raising. When I say I've never been a student of Polanyi, I mean that my interest in him has not been scholarly in any way at all. It has never tempted me, nor has indeed that of the writings of any other seminal thinker, tempted me to exegete that text with as much fidelity as my capacity permitted. That kind of a relationship to a text is not only not one that I never had in relation to the text of Personal Knowledge and Polanyi's other writings, but of any other. I mentioned last night using Hannah Arendt's The Human Condition as a text in an upper level undergraduate course, and I don't consider myself, even though I have gone through this text at least 25 times with students, as being any kind of an authority on the thought of Hannah Arendt. Taylor Scott is much more of a scholar of Hannah Arendt than I am. Now, the point that I'm trying to make is not simply of anecdotal interest, but of philosophic interest. That is, a text for me is the basis upon which I enter into a colloquy with the thinker before me, and
interject what the author is saying to me. And therefore, I would never want to say, well, the proper interpretation of this is so-and-so. The same is true of my relationship to the texts of Kierkegaard. I had lifelong read Kierkegaard in this funny way I have with books. And that is, I'm looking for something that is speaking to me out of this text. And if you say, well, he didn't mean that, I will say, I don't care. Now, this is why, this attitude of mine is one of the many reasons why I was never awarded a James B. Duke professorship. been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Now, let me see if I can make clear what it is I'm trying to say about this. I don't know anything anymore about Polanyi's thought. Certainly not more than anybody else. What I know is that I have had this lifelong relationship, most especially to the man, who to me was the very embodiment of human greatness. And it will surprise you to learn that though I spent many hours and days and months in the company of Michael Polanyi, as often as not as his body servant, and grateful for this privilege, we almost never had philosophical discussions. Now, you might say, what an opportunity to throw away. You could have asked him so-and-so and found out what he really meant. And the fact is, in the accepted sense of this, I didn't care what he really meant. Now that, as you can see, Charlie, this puts me in a very bad position to comment at length on how I differ from Polanyi. Because this suggests that there's something out there known as Polanyi, and I'm in a position to say how what's in this book differs from that. Now, I hope you understand I'm not at all trivializing the import or the importance of your question. I'm trying to put it into the focus that enables me to comment upon it. Having said that, let me show you that in the text of Personal Knowledge, Polanyi is at once, within the space of, say, 350 to 400 words, a creature of the Copernican revolution that I have been trying to embody in my books, and a creature of the critical point of view which he is at pains to set aside. Wally Mead sent me a paper the other day and calls attention to this in the body of Personal Knowledge. It's a contradiction that I have noticed many times before for myself. I've got this book so written up I can't find the page numbers. But the sentence on 190, the famous sentence on 191, which is the basis of the beatitude which is being bestowed upon me here now. 191, Polanyi says, our acceptance of what is logically anterior is based on our prior acceptance of what is logically derivative as being implied in our acceptance of the latter. Now, using my language, Polanyi is up to his groin in the Copernican revolution that I am talking about here. He clearly apprehends the problem about axiomatization in math, which is the immediate context of this, but it applies throughout. In the temporal, pretensive, retrotensive dynamic that we apprehend through our own mind-bodily existence. And so when I made this an epigraph to the Polanyian Meditations, I felt that this was indeed the heart of this book for me. And I took a great deal of time trying to unpack that sentence. In other words, Polanyi has given in saying those words and writing those words, he has given in to the sovereignty of his own embedded language. He is caught in the midst of the pretensive, retrotensive dynamic of living mind bodily in the world, where you distinguish between the logically anterior that is based on our prior acceptance of what is logically derivative. Now, when I first read that, I said, that can only be understood in musical terms. That is, in terms such as we would employ in order to show the difference between one note and then another note and then another note, on the one hand, and a melody where the first note pretends the second note and the second note retrotends the first note. Now, as I say, about 350 words further on in the text, still talking about axiomatization. This is page 192. He says, let us remember once more that logical antecedents derived from the prior acceptance of their consequence are necessarily less certain than the consequence. Now that is doubly odd because he is reminding the reader and clearly reminding himself of how he thinks about the relationship between a logical antecedent and a logical consequence. And he occupies the relationship to his own words that is classically abstract logical. In other words, he's denying in what he says in this most recently quoted line what he has said in the previously quoted line. In other words, he has backslid from the Copernicanism that I am claiming is to be found in the first of the sentences that I quoted and the second one. Now, you know, I'm not making a big deal of this. I'm trying to illustrate in a concrete way how it is possible at once or successively to be fully Copernican, to use my language, on one page and pre-Copernican or critical on the next page. Now, I have not gone through the text of personal knowledge looking for further evidences of his Copernicanism or of his lapses from Copernicanism. That's the sort of thing that a responsible scholar would do, and maybe one of you in here will do that now that you've heard about this thing being there. But, Charlie, in an oblique way, I see my calling attention to the juxtaposition of these two propositions in which Polanyi is relating to his own words
is different than one from the other, as being some kind of comment upon the question, how do you differ from Polanyi and how are you liking? And the answer is, I'm liking 191 and I'm different from 192. And that's about all I have to say on that. And that's very disappointing, I know, because you're looking forward to having the whole morning filled with this sort of thing. Now, what was the second part of the John? The relation of action and language, I think, was the general topic I suggested there.
For yeah, second volume. Yeah, all right.
But before we go to the next volume, could we pursue the first?
Yeah, certainly, sir.
Pursue
away, Richard.
Yeah, you know very well my appreciation for your work in the Yellow Leaf. But it is true what you said, that we try and figure out how to formulate this in a way of keeping it useful. The difference that stands out between Bill 15 and Michael Polanyi. But the ones that I think you might expect, I mean, if Polanyi is trying to start something, I mean, I think there is a problem with being at that point, he's trying to do a post-critical philosophy, which may apologize in some way for what you call laughter. I mean, and as you show, he himself is not aware of the way he was turning language and starting to use it.
Right.
But the thing that I guess I think of the two of you is Polanyi was somewhat concerned about another issue that doesn't stand out, and that's true about free society. I mean, the whole domain of ethics emerges from this concern. But again, that's historical. I mean, it's his setting, you know, what he's involved in. In a way, it's like you have taken up a task as if you were to take that inside of Polanyi and then try to do something with it. That's what I felt when I read your Polanyi meditation.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to walk through, for maybe the first time, really thinking very consistently in a critical way. It was really challenging. I was not sure, after having done that, how this still would affect Polanyi, because I was kind of saying, what would he be doing today, you know, if he were around? I think he probably would be very much concerned about a lot of political issues,
yes,
that we're not,
yes,
involved in.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, that's a difference.
Well, I think
maybe
that
once it's too obvious to comment
on. It isn't too obvious to comment on, and indeed you are right to remind us of that, and also to suggest what is the case, that I have not, in any of my writing, dealt with that whole dimension of Polanyi's own writing, which are concerned with ethics, public policy, the community upon which science is based, which is his particular model for talking about that upon which all community is based.
But you admit the disease.
Sorry?
I mean, but you attack the disease underlying the problem.
It's just partly a difference between two kinds of intellectual temperaments. And I think an interesting anecdote on this point is helpful. When I first showed Michael the rough draft of what later became the chapter in Intellect and Hope, I met him at the Carolina Inn on a beautiful Sunday morning. We had breakfast, and he had the paper and read it, and he held it on his lap and patted it. And I thought that was pretty honest right there. And he said, I think this is very important, which I hope you will understand. I mean no disrespect by observing that this meant, I don't know what you're talking about. But then he went on to say, you know, Bill, see, we have to be quite strict. Now, I found that fascinating in a man who had devoted so much energy and writing to attacking false ideals of strictness and exhaustibility. But then I realized, well, that's a trivial kind of biographical fact about Michael Polanyi. What is of interest here is that in saying we have to be quite strict, he was saying you can't talk this way about such questions. He would never have said that, and indeed I doubt if he even thought that. What I'm suggesting is he felt uncomfortable with the kind of thing that I was doing there, and that clearly anticipated what I came later on to do in these books. Now, let me make one further point about a difference between Polanyi and me. And it's a very funny question for me to be putting to myself and trying to answer, because it's just, I don't know, it's weird. But I know that we're in a weird environment, even in the Polanyi Society.
And the AAR appropriately meets near the zoo, too.
What I want to say is that it's interesting to compare the impact of the reiteration of the from to tacit explicit image with the retrotensive pretensive image that I find central to what I'm trying to do. In other words, Polanyi knows full well in the sentence on 191 that the antecedent retrotends, consequent retrotends the antecedent, as the antecedent pretends the consequent. And I'm not suggesting that he would deny what I'm saying here, because he said it here. But I'm suggesting that one of the ways that he commits the faux pas, as I'm claiming it to be, on the next page, is that he was seduced by his own image of from to, because does not accompany this with a to from. I don't think that this difference between us is a great deal of importance, except insofar as it sheds some kind of light on what's going on in these books of mine. Now, have I been properly responsive to your concern here, Richard, with what I've said?
I think so. Sort of what I would expect. I just think one of the differences where I think it's the difference.
I think that when Polanyi said we have to be quite strict here, is we have to be upfront. A phrase that he, though he was quite fond of using American colloquialism, I don't think he would have used in this case. His mode of argumentation was very conventional, and he used with great effect his vast command of scientific illustrations for his argument, which could be supported by and illustrated with models from other fields. Now, to get to action and speech, like everyone, you included Charlie in the 50s and the 60s, mostly the 50s. I read all of the Oxford Ordinary Language stuff, and 52 when Philosophical Investigations came out in translation. I participated in a joint UNC Duke Philosophy Department seminar that met the sole exception in my experience being the faculty of Guilford College, where I conducted some seminars, and to my great astonishment, I found this going on there too. It's Quakerism that does it, I'm sure.
And you still remember it.
Well, to cut a long story short, as I read these materials, I kept saying to myself, there's nobody there. Even when you read the Philosophical Investigations, you imagine Wittgenstein lecturing in his room, leaning up against the wall with his eyes shut, talking what later came to be written down as the Philosophical Investigations. In other words, for all of the fact that he frequently introduces an imaginary interlocutor to which he then offers an answer or a comment, the Philosophical Investigations are anything but oral power. Now, this is in no sense to diminish their enormous power and value and their influence on my thinking. But I kept wanting to say, if the meaning of a word is its use in the language, then what about the user? Because I kept feeling that I was a user, and that the relationship that stood between the meaning of the word in the language that I use and my subscription to that usage was central to the whole business about language. And in terms of what was being said last night on in various ways about what I described as my Yahwism, I suppose that it was my Yahwism coming out at the point where I felt that the linguistic philosophers who were doing such exciting things were, in the last analysis, aesthetes in the Kierkegaardian sense. Oh, they were serious in pursuing their various dialectical explorations. But in a funny sense, there was nobody there, in the sense in which Abraham was there when Yahweh spoke to him. And Abraham, now Abraham, previously known as Abram, answered. So, my interest in speech and action turns around that image. And this is why I believe that if you wanted to try to come up, which I don't necessarily want to do, but if you wanted to come up with a model of what it is for us to be men, women, I would say we are distinguished from all other beings by the fact that we have the possibility of speech
and of taking responsibility for speech. And this precisely constitutes our freedom and our transcendence. Now, did you have more that you were hoping for in this story, Charlie?
Well, I think that defines your own position quite clearly. And it may be that it isn't relevant as to what you think Polanyi would say on this point, but I'd be interested to see whether you do have a view on that, because it seems to me as though Polanyi does not take that point of view.
He doesn't, and he is indeed, as you will remember, there's a footnote in there about Wittgenstein, whom he simply more or less summarily writes off. And with all due respect to Marjorie Greene, this is Marjorie Greene's fingerprints in the text, because Marjorie, to this day, has little good to say about Wittgenstein or anybody else. Yes.
Okay, I wanted to go back to the question of language and get you to talk a little. I think the direction that would help me is if you talked about the difference between what you're saying and what Wittgenstein is saying. And because Wittgenstein, when he says the meaning of a word that you use, is slightly different from what I heard you saying, that language has the two meanings of our body, which have been birthed. And there's I feel like I can grasp fairly easily the notion that concepts derive from our mind body, so that the visual world, even though dynamic, is often crystallized into the static and definite. But when I think about individual words, it's more difficult. So the long section where you talk about tendere and tension and wretched tension as deriving from our mind body, there seems to be a kind of, for lack of a better word, an intuitionism or a kind of jump that you have that it's hard for me to follow exactly. And I think if you maybe address some of that.
Well,
sorry. Before you get so long, let me just add one character story that relating to that.
Yeah.
When you said that, you said that the language, ordinary language alone, you see, is fundamentally essay.
Yes.
You were including Wittgenstein in that.
Yes. Now, it's very hard to think of Wittgenstein as an aesthete because I think that the point has been made, and I think it has been established, that Wittgenstein's interest in language, and this dates all the way back to the Tractatus, is in the service of clearing the deck of everything that could be said in order that that which can't be said, namely that which shows itself, which is of the ultimate interest to Wittgenstein, and is ethics. But even so, I assent to the proposition that you've suggested here, that Wittgenstein is, in common with these other linguistic philosophers, and of philosophy, especially in the modern period, generally is aesthetic in the Kierkegaardian sense. Now, to get to your question, Beth, my disquisition on the etymology of the word pen, and I will not rehearse that, but you'll know where to find it in Blanyan Meditations, is that this word seems, and all of its cognates and all of its etymological roots, all the way back to Sanskrit, is a particularly useful way to illustrate the point that I'm trying to make about language being rooted in our mind bodies, and that is, how can you understand the word intend without apprehending that in the intentionality of your act of reaching for something?
So all of the Sanskrit roots tin, tan, tone, and tune, the consonant in there allows for these variations that issue in the whole history of the meaning of this word. In every one of its cognates and branches, one apprehends that word in one's body as an intentional being. And if you weren't, then none of this could make any sense to you. Now, I don't recall that I used this illustration for this purpose. Taylor, in his piece in Tradition and Discovery, makes some considerable use of it and elaborates on it in a most interesting way in the relationship between his grandson and his daughter-in-law as she's feeding her infant. But he cites the experiments that were made at Edinburgh by a group of psychologists, one of whom was clever enough to devise a way of filming the behavior of neonates, sometimes less than a month old, and slowing the photographs, the motion pictures that he was taking, slowing them down in such a way that he could show that it was not the case, as had previously been supposed, that the movements of the hands and feet of neonates are random, simply random discharges of energy, but were in fact coordinated in a positively balletic way with the rhythms in which their mothers spoke to them. I've never seen these movies, and I'm reporting on a written report on all of this, but it's a marvelous experiment. It's the sort of thing that Polanyi would say, would characterize as a beautiful experiment. Because what it shows is that before we are a month old, we are already dwelling in the rhythms of our ambient world that we apprehend both as the sound of the loving voice of our mothers and the rhythms of their movement as they hold, support, fondle, caress, and baby talk to us. And as one of these authors observed, when we talk baby talk to children, we are recovering our own pre-verbal powers, which were themselves the conditions of our having acquired language. And the way you talk to a baby is with baby talk, except some exceptionally modern liberal parents who want to open the day with a reading from the Transcendental Deduction of the Categories. Good day. Now, am I getting...
Yeah, that helps. Particularly,
I know why you're asking this, because, as it were, intellectually, I know where you live. And so I'm eager to contribute further to the development of your interest here. What else do you need to know about this?
No, I think that helps clarify for me. Particularly when you just talk about reaching for something physically, and that... The child, the precondition for learning language is being an embodied person. So I think that it's clarifying.
Well, Beth, you and I are on exceptionally good terms with AT&T. If
if this is truncated, give me a ring. Even though your husband went to the Notre Dame game, for which I can forgive you, but not him.
Elder? This discussion really raised a bunch of responses, but I'd like to follow up first just on your comment about from to what the to from. It seemed to me that a lot of people would agree with you about most of that, but I just want to get a quick reading if they make any sense. That when we dwell in particular from which we think to a certain quote of meaning, we then may indwell that meaning. And when we indwell that meaning, it is then something that is potential for us to take from again. And so it's kind of a circular pattern. And so in music, for instance, we would be indwelling not only the notes at a moment, but the sense of how the melody is going to be developed in the past at the same time. So that there is this kind of mutuality to the relationship.
Yes, I absolutely agree, and in order to make a point, I vastly oversimplified the import of the from to image in Polanyi's thought, because he clearly is not as simple-minded as my use of that illustration might have suggested. I'm rather more interested not in what it does to Polanyi as to what it does to us. And if we are not careful, then we can be easily seduced by the facial metaphor underlying the from to, particularly if you think of from to as going from here to there, with the consequence that when you're here, you're no longer there. So, yes, I certainly subscribe to what you said.
That's another...
Oh, you said you had a plethora, so let's have it.
I wanted to use one more. I guess it's really more of the heart. What I heard last night in the kind of community of discourse that created last night. I guess my question has to do with world versus world. I certainly understand what you're saying when you say that our discussion opens up a new world. Conjures up a new world. That's right. A new world that was not before. And so can an opera, so can music, as your familiar creation things. My question is, how do these various worlds that open up relate to the notion of the world? Is the notion of the world a notion that you feel comfortable with as something that we are all grounded in? Would you want to get at that through a kind of hierarchical kind of view, or how would you try to deal with perhaps the issue almost of truth? Are you going to subscribe mainly to a correspondence, I mean a coherent theory of truth of what I'm hearing? Have some Hegelian overtones of what I was hearing you say?
Oh, good heavens.
You don't have to insult him. Just go ahead.
Or do you want, I think, Polanyi would certainly refer much more of a correspondence theory. Do you want to subscribe to that?
I don't want to subscribe to any of that. The very, with all due respect, I'm going to come quite bluntly at what you said. And almost every one of the familiar philosophical categories that you offered me as options, like a coherence theory or a correspondence theory, the question as to the world and a world, all of these are rendered moot by what I tried to describe last night as a Copernican revolution. Now, I have no trouble, I'm just like everybody else in this room. I use the word world in a very commonsensical way. You ready? They do this better at Furman than at Rancher's Mansion.
Unless I come over as too much of a smart ass, which I am, but try not to come over as. Do you understand what I mean when I say that the coherence versus the correspondence theory is rendered moot by what I've been trying to argue?
I hear you saying that, but I don't agree.
Yes. You don't agree because you are, as I would argue, still a creature of Ptolemaicism. So I might use the astronomical And what to do with someone like you? And I think probably...
I'm really bad off.
You're bad off only when you're at a meeting of the Polanyi Society at the AAR, because otherwise you're just an ordinary human being that gets around quite satisfactorily from one thing to the next without having a coherence as opposed to a correspondence theory of truth. All of these things were made up, and we don't need them. Indeed, they, in specific cases, can be quite misleading. But let me be fair here and say the choice between coherence and correspondence is rendered moot as a theory of truth, are rendered moot when the nature of the relationship that obtains between you and the world, whether that's the world in this room that we all at the moment share, or is something else altogether. You can't even get a surgical scalpel between you and the world in which at the moment you're dwelling. So you then don't have a problem of, well, how do you get from here to there? Because you're already there.
Walter, could I interject question quickly? Would you agree from your understanding of Polanyi that he would also say those questions are moot?
He wouldn't say that.
What would he say?
I think he would say what he does say. I believe that what he says in his book that bears on the question you're raising here is in the invocation of the notion of assertion with universal intent. And I, myself, feel a bit uncomfortable with this because it seems to me that Polanyi, you know, betraying, oh, that's too strong word. He suggests that we need something to account for the fact that we have a coherent world. And that thing that is needed and that he supplies is the notion of universal intent. Now, this is a fine distinction. And one that I, you know, have no investment in whatsoever, but I'm trying to answer your question as honestly as I can.
A fine distinction can be taken in two ways.
At least.
Yeah.
I bet you I could come up with
it. But it doesn't seem to imply necessarily a coherence or a correspondence.
Notion of truth.
I wonder whether it doesn't moot it in fact.
Well, it's mooted. Let me speak for myself. Coherence is an actuality upon which we rely literally every moment of our lives in a thousand and one different ways. Mm-hmm.
nothing problematic. I wager that there's nothing problematic for anyone in this room about how to get from here to the men or ladies room.
Except the linguistic problem, it says gentlemen, and I want to know where the rest of us go.
I thought you were going to call attention to the fact that the storm has backslid into referring to female
gender of the ladies.
No, they say women and gentlemen. This is one of the things that are interesting. They're much linguistic. Go ahead. Excuse me.
Yeah, no. All right. Now, let me come back to you. We have left you there.
Go ahead, Walter. Another part of the plethora.
Let me think a little bit about what you said about reality.
Yeah.
Let me give a reading that I think again you say gender neutral. I heard you in the way you dealt with Trump as making a daring move in saying that even the idea of the sin itself, of course, is still an idea, still there within our world. But you can this alternative to the conscience effector beyond the Hegelian notion of reason, what kind of mind bothers me beyond. Because I think it was important to move that I really understand. But I want to say that there's something more than that, more than we're already here, that we are embodied in. I want to say that our thought rises out of inchoate, unknown embodied aspects of community, which, because we cannot articulate adequately, we need to point to its ongoing presence. Where I guess I want to turn something like a string of sound as that which we carry common through when we articulate it in the stage of the level of language. But I guess a way of getting it kind of further, going back to Polanyi's from two structures of consciousness. In my own opinion, I make it a from via to Christian. Via being the living thing, mediating that, being there from that embodied aspect of life, from which we think, transform linguistically into something that can be met and they can communicate to another. It seems to me what I hear you saying is stemming this via aspect of reality, great, down in the human ideas, but leaving that from still a linguistic form. You know, you're talking about that. I think we somehow need, my sense of reality says, we've got a person more than our own human experience, that there's more there.
More than our own human experience. Well, is this more than our human experience or this thing?
It is increasingly serious that the roots of our being, as you get the skills that we're not conscious of to those we're standing conscious of, and so forth, since we have just insight into them, I think it impacts us the way.
Yeah. Well, I think that the difference between us is perhaps non-existent entirely, but at most. Might. I want to say that the world, see, I use that word without any heavy phrase about the world, but the world is what we all know it to be. And if it's a consolation to you, I'm perfectly happy to say
It's out there. And not in here. It's at the very moment that you and I are exchanging these words, right there between us, embodied in what you say and what I say, and the corporeal setting out of which you say what you say, and that out of which I say what I say, and so on. But you know, that's, we don't need all of that. We could say it. So, in other words,
if you are
fearful that I am some kind of an idealist, I would simply say, wrong. Because idealism gets its faction from the option real of an idealism, and what I am trying to argue to renders that distinction moot by finding the ground upon which all meaning and meaning discernment
derive and to which they retrotend. And I guess that's all I had to say. Dale, you wanted to interject something.
Suggesting that it might be